podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and John O'Bacon. Episode 77 for July 11th, 2009. Jaunty Jackalope. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers each and every week the free, the Libre, the open source software with your host, Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Leo, good to talk to you again.
Nice.
My
to
sock
see you.
Opening. There you go. I could just put that on tape now and keep playing it back and forth. But there we go. Hey, Leo. Good to hear you.
Also here, the great John O'Bacon, who today is doing double duty as both host and guest.
That's right. He'll have to talk to himself.
Yeah, will you be interviewing yourself, John O? I don't know.
Yeah, I've got a great conversation lined up. It's all about from start.
So Randall and I just sit back while you talk to yourself. This should make a great show.
Well, just as a little background.
Are you really awesome? Yes, I am awesome. Are you really that awesome? Yes, I am.
As a little bit of background of why we actually have John O on as a guest this time. When I brought John O on the first time, we really covered a lot of his life, a lot of all the things he's doing, all the different places he's at. And we really didn't get into Ubuntu very much. We you know, the whole new release of Jaunty Jackalope has some significant new features. And we just didn't get into that. And I actually got a bunch of email right after that show saying, you had John O on and you didn't actually talk about Ubuntu?
So are you nuts?
So this is the purpose of this show. I wanted to bring John O back on as a guest again, not as a co-host as he's been for the last few weeks. And actually talk about his day job, actually talk about what he does and what Ubuntu is and all that stuff. And so so that's why Jono's back as a guest.
That's fantastic. So what do you do, Jono? Can you tell us what do you do for a living?
It's all booze and blogging. That's it. So my job is the Ubuntu community manager, and my role is basically to try and enable the Ubuntu community to do good work, is what it basically boils down to in a nutshell.
No, yeah, it's not a marketing job then, per se.
No. There's been this kind of ongoing debate in the kind of technorati, kind of, you know, the blogging, micro-blogging kind of commentating pundit world about whether community management should report to engineering or whether it should report to marketing. And I'm kind of a bit of both, but more slanted on the engineering side. So
community that you manage is the community of contributors to the source.
Yeah, it's predominantly contributors. It's on one hand, it's people who do packaging, who do software development, who do kind of technical kind of work. And on the other hand, it's things, you know, people who do things like advocacy. We have like 200 user groups all over the world, a bunch of user groups called Loco Teams. They go out and they have events and all manner of good work. And it's focused on those folks as well. So it really does kind of mix both engineering and marketing. I mean, a good example is on one hand, the engineering side, we look at like developer workflow, such as bug triage workflow and how we can optimize each of the steps there. But then on the other hand, it's, you know, getting CDs in the hands of people and helping people to make a big noise about Ubuntu in a social capacity.
Can we back up a second? For the people who don't know at home, all 3% of our audience that doesn't know the answer to this question, what is Ubuntu?
So Ubuntu is a Linux operating system. Ubuntu is an ancient African word meaning humanity to others. And so it basically started with this guy called Mark Shuttleworth, who is a South African entrepreneur. He used to run a company called Thought, and he sold it to VeriSign. And then he used some of that money to go into space, obviously.
And literally, not like space out, but literally.
No, he
became an astronaut.
He trained in Russia and went into space. He was the first South African astronaut. He went up there and did his space thing, and then he came back down. And then while he was on a boat going to Antarctica, I believe is the story, he picked a series of well-known contributors who were involved in Debian, which is another free software operating system. And he picked those people to hire them to come and build Ubuntu, which is an easy-to-use Linux operating system that's built on top of Debian.
So Debian is a kind of Linux and Ubuntu is a kind of Debian then?
Yeah, it's broadly. So Debian is a project that's been around for a long time. It's entirely community driven, and Debian is renowned for its really high quality technical foundations. And the Debian project build thousands of packages and build this big system. And they've got different desktops and different editors, and it's very, very diverse. The problem with Debian is that you kind of, particularly at the time back in 2004, you really needed a degree in rocket science to know how to use it. Fortunately, this South African guy probably does actually have a degree in rocket science. so he identified the fact that Debian's a great distribution, but maybe another distribution that's built using Debian that's really focused on ease of use could be the next step forward. So there were some seemingly simple decisions made, but actually made a lot of difference. So, for example, choosing one text editor, choosing one Office suite, and shipping all of that on one disk is a big deal, because back then, you know, you'd get SUSE and it would have like 7 disks, and it, you know, you'd need loads of disk space and you get a load of cruft in your machine that you didn't want. So the focus with Ubuntu was to really create one disk with a set of high quality applications that were all integrated together.
Who determines? I mean, I think that's a great idea, by the way, because you get the idea, at least in my mind, is you get the best in class in each of these. But that's got to be a contentious choice. Who decides?
It can be. I mean, so some of the original technical decisions were made by kind of the founding fathers of Ubuntu. So, for example, the decision to use the GNOME desktop I don't know who made that specific decision, but it was a decision that was made of best of breed at the time.
There are other Ubuntu versions. There's Kubuntu that uses KDE. Yeah. There's Shubuntu, which I think uses XFCE.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's other derivatives that use different desktops, or for example, Ubuntu Studio, which is focused on, you know, on video and audio editing, things like that.
Right.
But the decision that works right now is that, you know, so we have a set of applications that we ship right now. If another application is proposed, then there's a discussion in the community about it. So I'll give you an example. We have a media player that we ship with Ubuntu right now called Rhythmbox. And there's been a lot of discussion about shipping another media player called Banshee with Ubuntu. And we had a discussion at the Ubuntu Developer Summit about, you know, whether that made sense from a features and integration perspective, you know, what was missing in Banshee that we'd need to have developed, all that kind of stuff. So
I know that when I run Synaptic or the update program, one of the preferences is contribute that information back in, so that for a popularity contest. Is that information also used?
The PopCon results is interesting. It gives us a broad idea. It's not entirely used because popularity is not necessarily a great indicator of quality.
Look at this show, for instance.
Well, anyone who watches American Idol will be able to
there you
see
go.
That.
That's right. That's right.
It's. I think there's a. It's a good indicator about what where popularity lies, but there's many, many decisions that are made in terms of what we decide to go on the disk. And simple things like disk space. I mean, when you've got 650 meg to play with, you start running out of space pretty quickly, and just having enough space and, you know, to fit stuff into the disk is really complex at times.
Is that always going to be 650? I mean, you must be feeling like you're hemmed in a little bit by that size.
Oh, absolutely! It's always really complex to kind of fit everything in. I mean, this is not something
it's a good discipline.
Yeah, well, it is, and we have a conversation every so often in the community about, you know, whether it makes sense to move to DVD. I mean, we do have DVDs available, DVD images that people can download and burn. But the simple reality is that there's just not enough machines that are shipping with DVD writers, so many people will download Ubuntu and burn it to a disk and install it. And there's many machines that don't have that. I mean, just think about all the netbooks is a good app.
Well, actually, I use a USB, you know, a pen drive to install my netbook. That's a really great way to do that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think obviously at some point I imagine that we will move over to it, but I think it'll be a little while yet.
Yeah,
but
it's nice, though. It fits on a 1 gig thumb drive, which nowadays is like comes in a cereal box. I mean, you know, gig. Who wants a gig? So it's perfect. I keep that one around, and I actually put the netbook Remix on there. Are K Ubuntu and X Ubuntu and the Remix, are those all official Ubuntus? Are all those underneath the umbrella of Ubuntu?
Some of them are. So the official blessed kind of versions that we have Ubuntu, which is kind of the predominant release that most people tend to use. Then we have Kubuntu, which is based on KDE. We have Zubuntu, which is based on XFCE. Those are the kind of the three major ones. We did have a distro called Edubuntu as well. And that's kind of regressed a little bit. But then, for example, Ubuntu Studio is not, I don't think it's official right now, if I remember right, but there's so much work going into that distro that, you know, we sponsor, you know, some of the folks from Ubuntu Studio to, you know, to our developer summits and things like that. So we try to provide as much support as we can. But being an official Ubuntu basically means that we'll sponsor the project. We'll provide, in many cases, we'll provide disks with the distro on there. So, for example, you can get Kubuntu disks and Ubuntu disks from shipit.ubuntu.com, things like that.
I think that's so cool. In fact, to me, this is the biggest thing you've done to spread Linux to normal users is, I mean, you know, sophisticated users know we can download them. You know, we can go to Linux ISO and we can download any version of Linux. But for somebody to be able to go online and say, okay, ship me a disk is huge. Yeah. That's huge. I can tell people on my radio show who are not sophisticated, you know, they call in and say, I have a Pentium 4 with 512 megabytes of RAM. What can I do? And I'll say, go to Ubuntu. They'll send you a disk for free. That's great. Yeah. You know, that's the easy answer.
And it's been tremendously popular. I mean, as you can imagine, I mean, there's a certain
amount. Does Mark pay for that?
Yeah. So this comes out of obviously this is a service that we provide at Canonical to send the disks out, and we send a lot of disks out. I mean, it's been hugely popular. It's been really the thing I really liked about the idea when I first heard about it before I worked at Canonical was the concept of people who don't have a burner, who don't have the ability to get the disk,
or they're on a 56K modem.
Yeah, exactly. They can go out and they can have it. And the distro is not reliant on a network, because a big focus for us is making sure that people in parts of the world that don't have good, you know, predominant networking facilities can have access to free software. And it's important that we don't forget that, as everybody is obsessed with Facebook and Twitter and everything else. We don't forget these nations.
This is huge, yeah.
What's sort of interesting about Ubuntu the first time we ran across it was just how friendly it is, how easy it is. Mm. It just keeps getting easier with each new release. But it's like Ubuntu is one of the few releases that I know I can hand somebody who doesn't have experience with it, maybe anything other than Windows, and be able to use it out of the box.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that really attracted to me. So before I worked at Canonical, the thing that really attracted me to working there was the idea that Ubuntu is an ethos that's broken into ease of use and an approach towards software and IT. And in terms of the ease of use side of things, I like the fact that that's been applied to the desktop and then to the server and to Ubuntu Network Remix and things like that. Because Linux back then, I remember back in 2004, was so complex. I mean, the thing I said to a few people is when I got started in Linux, it took 2 weeks in a soldering iron, and it literally did. My brother was sat there with a soldering iron making this thing work. And it was ridiculously complicated. He's like, oh, you can make that thing work. You just need to compile a kernel.
No sweat. Easy
no,
to do.
No worries. No worries. It's fine. And part of the attraction was getting involved in that. But, you know, I want my dad to be able to use something such as Ubuntu, and that's all the integration work that's gone into Ubuntu and other distributions as well, I think has been fantastic in bringing it to the masses.
That and the idea of a live CD, so somebody who doesn't want to, you know, repartition their disk yet or install it over the top of everything, they can try it out for a while and even actually use it that way for a while, editing their Office files using the Office.
But to be fair, Nopix did that first, but Ubuntu jumped on that very quickly.
Yeah, the live CD has been really popular. I mean, the first time I discovered how cool this was, you know, when I was installing a new system, and, you know, nobody likes sitting there just looking at the progress bar moving. So I was online and I was doing stuff while it was installing, and I could listen to my music as well, because you know, I was using Rhythmbox, and Rhythmbox has got a Last.fm plugin, and all I need to do is put in my login details, and then I could listen to my neighborhood radio. So I was listening to Lamb of God and Slayer while I was installing this, you know. So I was a happy boy that day.
That must be great. That's cool. Somebody in the chat room said that you're not actually tied to Linux anymore, that you can also run the FreeBSD kernel as part of Ubuntu.
Possibly, to be honest with you, news to me.
Who knows? The chat room is nuts sometimes. I decided to pass that along.
Exactly.
Why would you want to? I mean, you know, I have to say I've installed Johnny Jackalope, which is the new version 904, on a bunch of machines now. And I it's great. It's just beautiful. It's getting, you know, the big question, you know, maybe you guys don't get this question, and Randall, you probably don't, but the question I get as somebody who interfaces with normal people is Linux is Linux ready for the desktop? And I think that's the question everybody always wants to know. When is Linux going to be as easy to use as Windows or OS X? And nobody's done more towards this than Ubuntu. And I think you're very, very close now. I tell you, when I look at the Netbook Remix, for instance, it's easily the best OS for a netbook. It just is simple. It's straightforward. The upgrades, the patches, the installers, all of that happens in a way that is going to be very easy for anybody who's ever used a computer before. You're really close. And we've gotten rid of the, you know, apt-get and sudo and or sudo, if you want to be exact. Sudo. How do you say it? I like sudo.
It's interesting because I remember when I first got involved in Linux, I used to use a distribution called Mandrake.
That was a great one.
Exactly. And it was, you know, Red Hat made easy, which is the way they kind of did it. And I kind of think of them as kind of the precursor to Ubuntu in many ways.
That was our distro of choice on the screensavers for many years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was the easiest distro that you could use. But the problem I found with Mandrake back then was the fact that the underlying technology was not what it could be. Yeah. So I used to be a KDE developer, and when I was doing KDE work, I'd need to install all of these development tools to do some work. And part of the problem with that was the fact that, you know, you'd need one thing and that would require another thing and that would require another thing.
Dependencies.
And, you know, I'm not a big fan of commitment. And well, I wasn't back then. I am now. I'm married. But I fear I
Is your wife in the other room? You're in trouble now.
She's downstairs. Okay. I think I'm in trouble. Black cloud has just suddenly hovered over the house. But back then, you know, I was well aware of the fact that Debian had just such a phenomenal technical foundation with apt. And the underlying technology with that, even though it didn't have like the nice skin on the top of it, it was an amazing technical foundation. And I remember at the time saying to when I was doing some talks at conferences when I was a journalist, what we need is we need a Debian that's easy to use, either in the Debian project or somewhere else. And then Ubuntu showed up, and I was really excited. And that was what got me really excited. And I feel like we're getting closer than ever. And even though Ubuntu's done a lot of that work, I think it would be remiss if we didn't thank all of the amazing upstream projects such as GNOME and KDE and OpenOffice and those projects, because they really do some phenomenal work that we can ship in a distro like Ubuntu and deliver to our users.
So what is Jaunty Jackalope? What does that mean? What's new in this release of Ubuntu?
So for those people who wonder why the hell it's called Jaunty Jackalope.
Well, because if you have a hardy heron, where else are you going to go?
I think someone's going to cut that line out and use it against you.
Wouldn't be the first time. There's HH. Was there an II?
Yeah, there's the Intrepid Ibex.
Oh, yeah, Intrepid Ibex. So yeah, did you start with AA?
It started with the Warty Warthog.
That's right, Warty Warthog.
So each release has a code name, which is something like the Warty Warthog or the Breezy Badger or the Hardy Heron or whatever. And then we also have a number as well. And so, for example, this latest release is Ubuntu 9.04, which means it came out in 2009 in the fourth month. And that's how the numbering works. And in this new release has been really exciting. I think it's been really well received. I mean, obviously, when we pump out a release, it's such a relief getting the release out. But the following 2 weeks, we kind of sit there bated breath, wondering how it's going to go down. And the release has, you know, got some really great reviews and, you know, a very positive upgrade path, and people seem to be pretty happy with it. So, just in a nutshell, some of the features we've improved boot performance. There's a lot of focus going into boot performance in Ubuntu right now, and we're expecting further improvements in Karmic, which is the next release. We also shipped this new notification system, which we did some development work on, and that throws up these nice little notification bubbles. We have a media player called Totem, which now ships with UPnP support. It's got like a playlist plugin to search Demando, which is a free music website. You know, Wacom tab, you know those Wacom tablets for doing design work? They just hot plug straight in. Now you can just plug them in, they work. Multiple monitors is handled better. We've also shipped like a technical preview of X4, which is like the next generation file system, new kernel. So yeah, there's been some good focus on the desktop release. We've also had Eucalyptus, which is kind of a cloud deployment technology. There's been a technical preview included in Ubuntu server with that, and turnkey mail servers and that kind of stuff. So
are you on a schedule, release schedule? Is it like every year or?
Yeah, we ship every 6 months.
Every 6 months. Okay.
Yeah, it's a pretty hectic schedule because, you know, in that 6 months, you've got to gather feature. You've got to gather kind of requirements about what we want to focus on. And we have an Ubuntu Developer Summit each cycle where we fly a bunch of people from around the world into the same building. And we have, you know, 14 tracks where we talk through what we want to go into the next version of Ubuntu. And then we have feature development. And then, of course, we have freezes and we have testing times and bug fixing time, and all of that's crammed into a 6 month cycle.
That's a fast cycle.
How does that correspond with what Debian's doing upstream, and how much of the work that you do actually ends up going upstream?
So, in terms of Debian, the correlation is it kind of matches. Debian don't release every 6 months; they release. They have variable release schedules, and sometimes they'll take 2 or 3 years to ship a release. Sometimes they'll take 5 years to ship a release. Our release schedule is lined up with GNOME, which is the desktop that we ship. So we can ship a fresh GNOME when it comes out. In terms of how much of our work goes upstream, anything that can will go upstream. So anything from integration fixes, you know, when we fix bugs, they're sent upstream. Patches are sent upstream. Bug reports in the bug report tracking systems. new feature development goes upstream. Arc goes upstream. Pretty much everything that we can goes upstream. And I don't think there's actually anything that we don't send upstream, thinking about it.
That's a long answer to the short question there.
Yeah, that's good. In fact, yeah, everything. Okay. That's because I'm
the letter
on the
J goes upstream.
Mental and physical collapse.
So what's the minimum hardware that Jonty will run on? And is that getting bigger and bigger with every release?
You know what? That's a good question. I haven't checked for a while. It generally stays relatively consistent. I mean, I think, you can go and check the specific specs on Ubuntu.com.
It's not a particularly lightweight Linux. That's why you have Shubuntu, which runs in a much less RAM, I think.
Yeah, we do have, there are lighter Linuxes out there. I mean, people can run Linux on, you know.
On ancient stuff, yeah.
Yeah, some people run Linux on, you know, a toaster. And
was the decision? Yeah, you laugh. Of course they do. What else? But it was a decision, or is there a decision being made constantly about what hardware requirements will be? I mean, I kind of think it's good to have it kind of match this kind of middle of the road machine that's out there right now. You don't want to be too low and slow. You want to be able to be fairly modern.
That's the reason why. Yeah, I think that's pretty much the direction. I mean, we have discussions about hardware requirements. Most of the discussions are typically hardware enablement, so making new devices work. In terms of minimum specifications, it is discussed. It's not discussed particularly regularly. I mean, it will be discussed in a cycle. But generally, the requirements don't change that much between releases. Because we have 6 monthly releases, they're fairly iterative. So, you know, the release now... So a release may require a little bit more RAM than the previous release, but generally it's fairly iterative.
This is what it says. It says right now, Ubuntu is available for PC, 64-bit PC, and Intel-based Mac architectures. At least 256 megs of RAM is required to run the alternate install CD, 384 for the live CD installer, and install requires at least 4 gigabytes of disk space. So it's still pretty lightweight.
If you if you compare it to something such as Windows, it's hugely lightweight. Oh, yeah. and the thing I really love is the fact that we have distros such as Ubuntu, which will run on
even
on,
less. Yeah.
Even less. Because there's many organizations around the world. In my previous job, we used to work with a company that did this, where they take old hardware and install Linux on it and give it away to people who need computers and who don't have any money. And I really like those kinds of projects. So
Shubuntu is 128 megs of RAM, 192 to install, 1.5 gigs of free space on the hard drive.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, I think Mark, the whole point was kind of to be humanitarian, right? I mean, he wasn't trying to create a business out of this.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely creating a business with Canonical. I mean, Canonical is there like any other business to make
money.
There's
support revenue there.
Yeah, but the focus has very much been on producing a free software operating system and to produce a free software operating system that is in one form. Like, we don't have the community edition and the mm-hmm. enterprise edition. Mm-hmm. We have Ubuntu, and that's what everybody gets. So if you, we obviously have value added extras in Canonical, such as, custom engineering work, deployments, hardware enablement, all that kind of stuff we can do in Canonical and people can pay for. But the engineering that we pay all of our Ubuntu developers to work on and that we do in the wider community, everybody benefits. And I think that is really important when building a thriving community, is to make sure that there's a sense of equality of contribution. So when Joe Bloggs from Idaho does something in the Ubuntu community, it should benefit the wider community as well as benefiting customers as well.
Is Canonical physically located together, or you geographically spread out?
We are everywhere. I mean, literally, I think like over 25 countries, something like that. I mean, the vast majority of people in the company work from home. We do have offices in London, in Montreal, and in Taipei. But other than that, everybody works from home. The majority of people work from home, which is great.
Is working that hard? You're part of a team, obviously. I mean, you have a team, and I know that the developers have their own teams and stuff. But is that hard because it's geographically spread like that?
Not so much. It works. I actually find it works really well. So as an example, my team at Canonical, I have three people who work for me on the community team. One of them is based in Germany. Another one's based in Spain. And the other one's based in Michigan. So we're quite spread out. And we use, voice over IP to have meetings. We have weekly meetings. I have one-on-one calls with the guys. We use mailing lists and wikis. With all the technology that's available, it's pretty easy to work in a distributed capacity. The benefit I find is that I'm more productive working from home, because you know what it's like when you work in an office. You have constant distractions. You'll be sat there working on something and you'll be in the zone, and then someone will come over and want to tell you, want to talk to you about what happened in Lost last night. And, you get these constant distractions. The phone's always ringing. And it's particularly beneficial for me in California because everyone's in bed by the time I get to lunchtime. So everyone in Europe is in bed. So it's so I get the afternoon uninterrupted where I can really focus on getting stuff done.
I was going to ask then, because you have people in Germany and Spain, you must have time zone issues. You'll have to like always focus to have your meetings early in the morning for you here then.
Yeah, my day usually starts at 7 a.m. And I have calls pretty much all morning, and then I'm done by about lunchtime, and then I can start with the rest of the stuff. And sometimes, I'll have like midnight calls or 2 a.m. calls, but some people definitely suffer more. I mean, if you're in Australia, it's going to be harder. We have a natural gravitation, I'd say, towards Europe. We have a lot of the Ubuntu team are based in Germany. A lot of them are based in Europe. So a lot of meetings tend to happen on European time zones. But it works separate.
And those are Canonical people. You said Ubuntu team. Is that separate? Is that a different group?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about Canonical hired Ubuntu developers. But one of the benefits of being a distributed company is I think it makes you more... better for working with a community, because if everybody's in one office, you there's the ability to have that water cooler kind of situation going on where everyone's talking internally and it never gets outside. Whereas when we have meetings, like, so for example, the desktop team, who work on the visual desktop component of the distro, they have their meetings publicly in the Ubuntu in the Ubuntu IFC channel, and it means that everybody can join into those meetings. And we do that. We do that more and more. I mean, some meetings are private because they're to do with customers and whatever else. But the majority of the work that we do is out in the open as well. So the fact that people work from home, they have to engage with each other in Canonical via these channels as well, which makes the distro just naturally more open from a community and a governance perspective.
So how many people do you think are working full time on Ubuntu that aren't part of Canonical?
That's a good question. I mean, I'd say, in terms of full time, I have no idea. I mean, I could hazard a guess in terms of volunteers. I mean, I've usually plumped my guess at, in terms of active contributors, at sort of between 50,000 and 100,000.
Wow.
I mean, and that's a variety of different types of contribution. We have people on mailing lists, people going out doing advocacy. You know, we have about 300, 400 active packagers who are doing packaging work for Ubuntu. But the community is huge. I mean, there's a lot of people out there.
So the Canonical employees are actually just a small part of that then?
Very much so. I mean, Canonical is massively outnumbered by the community. But the, you know, what we tend to do, obviously, is we tend to have, you know, we tend to have great community people, and they demonstrate great work in Ubuntu, and then they tend to get hired because you know we like to hire good people.
One way to do it.
So yeah, it's one of the problems. You know, when you hire most of the great contributors, it can be kind of seen as the company like, so, you know, taking over. But it's just a case of, you know, trying you know, just getting great people to work in Ubuntu full time.
Well, you're doing
very cool.
You're doing it. There's no question about that. I mean, it's just great stuff.
Hmm.
What's coming in Ubuntu? What's your roadmap? Do you have a roadmap? Do you look that far ahead?
Yeah, we have roadmaps usually for the next 6 months. So we're currently working on the Karmic Koala.
I love it.
Yep. Cool. The Karmic Koala, that's what we're working towards. I was in Barcelona a few weeks back, and we were there for the Ubuntu Developer Summit, and there was a lot of discussion there about what we're planning on doing there. Boot speed is another thing that we're going to be continuing to focus on. Desktop interface improvements. We're wanting to fix lots of little usability bugs in the desktop and contribute those patches back upstream. There's discussions going on about easing how software is installed from a kind of a GUI perspective. New cloud improvements, virtualization improvements. There's all kinds of stuff going on. It's looking like it's going to be a really exciting release.
Along that thing that I was talking about, which is Linux on the desktop, at Ubuntu headquarters, is that considered a mission? Is that part of the job that you're trying to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're passionate about making Linux work on the desktop. I mean,
For the average user who as an alternative to Windows, I guess is really the.
Yeah, I mean, we're keen on various demographics of users. I mean, we're keen on power users, people who are passionate about Linux and open source. We're keen on.
You got to have them, of course.
Yeah, they will often drive, you know. If you invest your heart in that demographic of people, they will often invest their heart in that mission as well. And that will grow the amount of development that can occur. We're also passionate about, you know, business users. We're passionate about consumer users. And I mean, it's the mission is absolutely about making Linux on the desktop work. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
And what does that mean to you? Is it about, to me, it seems to be a couple of things. Installer, software installer, you know, eliminating the dependency issues. I think you've done a great job with Synaptic. It's really nice. Of course, you've got apt and apt-get underneath the surface, which makes it much easier to do. And then I guess having analogs for the most commonly expected desktop programs on other operating systems, you know, a Microsoft Word analog, which, of course, OpenOffice provides.
I mean, a lot of it that we do is we identify experiences. So, you know, we have a boot experience and we have a photo experience and a music.
Oh, interesting.
Experience. We identify these different experiences, and we try to cater towards them. So what we do is we often prioritize certain experiences in certain releases. So in this release, you know, boot experience is very important to us. You know, when Ubuntu used to boot, you got this, you know, screen full of gobbledygook that, you know, scrolled all the way down, you know, kernel messages.
Yeah, you don't want to see that.
Yeah, and all of that's been hidden away right now with the progress bar. But there's still things that are imperfect in the current boot experience. You know, there's still lots of flickering and mode switching going on, which we want to fix. What's really exciting, I think, is we're really getting into design. There's been a big investment in design at Canonical, and we've got this wonderful team who've been hired, who've, you know, experts in usability and interaction design, and they're working with upstreams and working with our community to identify areas of improvement in the design, in the user experience. And they kicked off a project called Project Ayatana. And Ayatana is a series of chunks of user interface improvement work that we're going to be building and deploying in Ubuntu. And the idea is this like sphere of consciousness that you have around you and how information is displayed. And we started seeing some of those improvements added in Jaunty. Like we have this messaging indicator and the notification indicator. We started seeing those improvements land in Jaunty, but they've got some great work that they're focused on. And what they're doing is they're putting real people in front of Ubuntu and doing usability tests. You know, they're putting mums and dads and business people in front of an Ubuntu computer and watching what they do and how they work and being able to solve problems by identifying what people do. So I'm really excited about the fact that we're seeing this kind of like extra perspective and skill coming into Ubuntu. And I think it's so important, you know, because Linux is it's a fishbowl. And, you know, I think sometimes if we just stay in the fishbowl and we get wrapped in the fishbowl, we won't make improvements to people outside the fishbowl. And I think the design team is helping to bridge that gap.
Yeah, Linux users are passionate and vocal, and they let you know what they want. These prospective desktop users aren't. They're just kind of this imaginary group.
And that is one of the things that plagues a lot of open source projects, right? Is that, you know, if I have the skill to create a program behind the scenes, it tends to not overlap very much with the skill to make something look pretty and usable. They're sort of like separate brain cells almost always. And so to have the flexibility that you have to bring in experts in that area for Ubuntu, that's really remarkable and good for everybody all around.
I think it's really important. I mean, there's many things that need to intersect. So, you know, to do great design is important. I think it's very important. It's a great contribution. But the hard thing is that how do you do that in a collaborative sense? You know, how, you know, everyone says the design by consensus never works, and everyone's right when they say that. So one thing that we're going to be learning, and this is new for open source, is, you know, typically people have collaborated together on code and documentation and translations and things like that. Whereas collaborating together on design, it's kind of like a new era to kind of move forward in how we work together. So we're going to be, you know, we're going to be learning a lot of steps ourselves in how we work together. So I have weekly calls with the head of the design team in Canonical to help her team identify ways in which they can work with the community in different ways, and to make sure that process is as open as possible. And that's what the Ayatana project is all about.
I hope, I'm sure it will actually, that you'll share whatever you're finding out of that process as widely as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of, so for example, with the notification applet that we developed in Ubuntu, that's, you know, the design thinking and the discussion around that was all out in the open. It was on wiki.ubuntu.com. It was in the mailing lists and that kind of stuff. And I think that's going to happen more and more and more. And I'm really passionate about the idea of enabling our local user groups, our loco teams, to do user interface testing and things like that. And that's something I'm going to be talking with Ivanka, who's the head of the design team, about.
And so, having a consistent way to capture the results of that and report that back in, and have it be in a way that you can aggregate the information, which will all be important.
Exactly. And that in itself is, you know, is a big subject, because one of my side interests, I'm really interested in interaction design usability, and it's really hard to do great usability testing because often it requires the insight of a usability engineer. And so I'm wondering, one thing I've been thinking about recently is how much we can do without having that insight, how we can capture that data, and then maybe have somebody who does have that insight to look over it. And then we can, but I think as time goes on, we'll build this kind of design expertise in the Ubuntu world. And And I mean, Ayatana is itself is an upstream project. I mean, it's not specifically tied to Ubuntu, but we're really keen on shipping Ayatana in Ubuntu itself.
Cool. Very cool. Looking forward to the results of all that.
Mm.
You waited right till he started drinking. Before. That was nicely done.
I thought so.
Yeah.
You're a good man.
At least you didn't do a spit take on camera.
We're looking for it. We're looking for it.
Here I go. No.
So is Canonical profitable? In other words, I know this was an altruistic venture, but as it sounds like, as it turns out, it's also been a good business.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're definitely making progress. I mean, the company's scaling so quickly. I mean, you know, when I joined, I think I was like 60, something like that.
That's surprising. I didn't realize it was that big.
I was at 60 when I joined, and now we're at, you know, over 250.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It's a big company.
What are all those people doing?
So we have a business team who goes out there to obviously to do business, to convince companies to use Ubuntu. We have, you know, OEM relations. We have people working with netbooks. We have people doing custom engineering for netbook makers. We have, you know, a large Ubuntu team. There's a large project that we work on called Launchpad, which is like a development forge. And Launchpad's really quite cool, launchpad.net. And we have a large team that work on that. And Launchpad's going to be open source in a few months. So all the Ubuntu development's done on Launchpad, and that's going to be really interesting to see when that's open sourced. And then Bazaar, which is a source control system that hooks very deeply in with Launchpad. Bazaar is going to we have a team that work on that, a team that work on a project called Landscape. We have a support team who answer technical support questions. People work in trademarks, lawyers. We marketing team, you know, all kind of. We're a real company.
That's good.
A real big company. Yeah, a real big company. Yeah, that's good.
It's certainly different to how it was. I remember when the office was like the size of my house.
Yeah.
And now it's you know, we're on this 27th floor in London of this big skyscraper, and you know, multiple offices, and yeah, it's great.
You know, it is pretty interesting that you're going to make Launchpad open source, because SourceForge originally was open source, and then they took it closed source.
Mm.
And so you're going the other direction with what your infrastructure.
I didn't know
that.
They took it closed source?
I think they did, didn't
That's
they?
That's weird.
That sounds
well, Launchpad was... I've been keeping a BDI on Launchpad, obviously, because it's so important to Ubuntu development. But I think the work that they've done there has been really good. I mean, as an example, bug tracking is just a perennially difficult problem to solve, and many people believe that, and I'd probably agree with them, that there's basically no 100% great bug tracker. You know, there's bug tracking is a difficult problem to solve, and that's really complicated with distributions, because for example, if someone files a bug for the text editor in Ubuntu, that's actually called gedit. Is a GNOME piece of software. So if the bug exists in gedit, does it exist upstream in the GNOME source code, or does it exist in the code that we ship, that we patch? You know, where does the bug exist? And you might have a bug report in our system, in the GNOME system, in the OpenSUSE system, and how do all of these different things talk to each other? It gets very, very complicated, and Launchpad has made a lot of those problems much easier to solve. So bug triage is one of the most notable ones, and translations is another.
And well, John, I've got lots more questions, but if you want to wrap it up, go right ahead.
I'm just going to say, I mean, it's been great to have John O'Bath to talk
so
about all
nice.
This.
I think John is a great addition to this show. And of course, we can always ask him because he's on all the time.
I'm going to always say
We can always ask him more.
Yes.
I noticed excellent driver support. In fact, you know, on my netbook, I have an MSI Wind. I had a little trouble on 8. But 904, everything works out of the box. It's really...
That's what we like.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
We like those stories.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. And that's the other side of the desktop equation. And a very tough one, because unlike the Mac world, where you know what the hardware is going to be, the PC world, it's so heterogeneous. And I don't know how you know what kind of hardware you're going to have to support. So
it's so complex. And, massive thanks have to go out to all the kernel developers, because the hardware support that those folks write is just incredible.
Well, your perfect example, you know, the 8 Hardy Heron didn't work with the wireless card that comes with the MSI Wind. Yep. Fixed it in 904, and it's in the kernel, of course, and supports there. And then I put in an Intel because, you know, now it will always be supported. You know, there's just it's just really great. I think that you've done a superb job. And it's as somebody who has recommended Linux for 10 years now as an alternative to Windows and even to Macintosh, it's really nice to see the progress that has been made from Mandrake, from Red Hat, Mandrake, to Ubuntu. And I use now I think Mint is an Ubuntu derivative as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
so I've also used Mint, but you make it's very easy to install all the extra stuff. That's what's so great about the package manager that you use.
I think we're on an exciting journey. I mean, the progress that's been made in 10 years in the open source world, in the wider open source world with Ubuntu and outside of Ubuntu, I think is remarkable. It's a remarkable achievement for everybody who's been involved. And I just think it's really exciting. And, you know, we will win it. You know, we will get there. I have absolutely doubt about it.
Good. I mean, good. You're so close. I mean, in fact, I think you could make a case you're there. Something like the Netbook Remix, unless somebody's got some unusual needs. I mean, it comes with Wine, and I wanted Evernote on there. You download the Evernote executable and run it, and it installs it. It even runs in the background. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It just works, and I think you're really, really there. It's just now it's an issue of getting people to feel more comfortable with it. But when they see the desktop, they see how familiar it looks, how easy it is to use, I think you're going to see it more and more. How about getting manufacturers to ship with Ubuntu? I'm sure that's a big part of your job, too.
Yeah, it's not something that I specifically work on, but we have a team that's just made some amazing progress there. And, you know, there's more and more manufacturers who are shipping Ubuntu. I mean, you know, the netbook deals has been remarkable, and the growth has been fantastic. And the team that builds that does the engineering work on the Ubuntu Netbook Remix and Ubuntu Mobile and all these different pieces, you know, they're doing a fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic job. You know, Linux is not just for people with enormous beards. You know, it's goes way beyond.
You're not telling me Richard Stallman has shaved, are you? I don't think so.
I never want to hear the words Richard Stallman has shaved ever again.
Well, Tim O'Reilly's here, so let's wrap this one up so we can get ready for our next one. John O'Bacon is, of course, the Ubuntu community manager. I'm sorry. Ubuntu,
yeah.
Community manager. and also, you know, the sometime co-host of this show. So it's nice to have you here.
And
everybody should run out and download Jaunty Jackalope 904, especially if you have a netbook, because it really is. It's the right size, shape. It's the right combination of features for a netbook. Runs beautifully. It's a really good choice.
Perfect. Thank you.
Anything we want to say before we wrap this one up, Randall Schwartz?
Just look at the upcoming shows at linked from twit.tv/floss, and you can send me email from there, too.
You can watch us do the show. We do it every Wednesday afternoon at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific. That would be, let's see, that's 1:30 is 13:30 plus 7, 20:30 UTC. The math is killing me, I'll tell you.
In the summer. In the winter, it changes to night.
Don't even start with summertime. Wintertime. Don't even go there. You can watch us live at live.twit.tv. Participate, too. We have a chat room, a friend feed room. They're asking me in friend feed, Jono. You have a Twitter account, of course, at Jono Bacon. Do you have a friend feed account?
I don't, actually.
I get you in there. Oh, you'll like it. Great conversations in there. We start a room every time we start a show, and it's a really
good thing. Don't go registering Jono Bacon at friend feed right now in the chat room there.
Give him a moment. Give him a moment to get in there.
Yeah, give me a second, all right?
Thank you, Jono. Thank you, Randall. We'll see you all next time on Floss Weekly.